The baby inside is sleeping, There's only one big problem. They have no legal rights to be here.
Just 3 weeks ago, Marie Pierre and her daughter Megan were living on the street. Now she lives in this spacious four-bedroom home. Her three other children will join her for the holidays.
I'm so looking forward to getting my other three children. They're going to love this space. And it's big. There's a nice yard. It's, you know, beyond being spacious. They will all each have a room for the first time.
There's just one huge technicality. It's not her house. She is squatting in a foreclosed vacant home.
I think it is immoral to have a vacant home that's being held by Lehman Brothers or anyone else while you have homeless families sleeping out on the street.
Pierre lost her home 4 years ago after she said her mortgage adjusted and running a family and studying for her PhD proved too much. She eventually ended up on the street. That's where she met radical housing advocate Max Rameau, who, with some help, broke into this vacant property, changed the lock, and moved her in.
Are you willing to go to jail? I mean, she could possibly go to jail.
But I do think that there are people who should go to jail. I don't think it's either me or her, but there are people who should go to jail because of this housing crisis.
2 years ago, Rameau and his group created a tent city in Liberty City on public land for homeless families. Now he targets vacant homes that are owned by the government or a bank and makes them available to families like Pierre.
I just can't even say anything. Because had he not given us this space, I would have been on the street.
And she actually put up this sign that people live here because someone apparently came in and removed whatever little possessions she had and changed the lock. She said she knows that she's here illegally, but feels victimized again because they took everything she had. Now, down to the business, according to county records, this home is owned by Aurora Loan Services, but I did call them. They did not return my call. Miami PD said they do not have any orders, Charles and Lori, to evict this family as of right now.
Well, Nikki, you folks are talking about the only one option is to be in this house or be on the streets. She is aware of homeless shelters and places that can help her out, isn't she?
Yes, she has been on the streets for like 4 years since her home was foreclosed up. She said she has lived in shelters. They could not accommodate her. They put her out on the streets. She's been in and out of the shelters for those last 4 years, and believe it or not, these past 3 weeks here in this home, she said, is the most stability she has had since 2003. Well, we'll see how this all plays out. And now that it's gotten publicity, we'll really see. Nikki Mohan, live for us in Miami. Around the corner to evict this family once again. You can see this family here sitting on their lawn, a family of 12. They say they have nowhere to go, and they are not leaving today unless police make them leave once again. Carolyn Conley and her family came armed with supporters and chants. The matriarch and her family were evicted from their foreclosed home at 849 Northwest 137th Street on Friday. After spending the weekend living in their van, they came to illegally move back in. Conley claims she lost her home because she did not understand her refinance mortgage.
This is my home. I'm here to take back my home.
We showed up with sheriffs here on Friday.
their family plural says they really do not have many options at this point. Several of them lost their jobs during this past year. That's why they moved back in here with their grandmother, now Lori and Charles. This woman said she thought she had a reverse mortgage and was paying only taxes when she realized that she was so far into back payments. She could not make that up. That's when the eviction notice came, and that's when the sheriff came to move her out of her home.
Good evening.
Good evening.
This is Max Ramon. I'm with the group called Take Back the Land out of Miami. Just to update you real quick on the family that you just saw, this video played on the day that we moved them back into the home from which they were foreclosed, and that happened on February 23rd, 2009. They sleep in the house every night and slept there last night, so they moved in here today. Out this evening, and of course I want to thank the Chicago Anti-Eviction Campaign for organizing this wonderful event. I also want to thank, in a much bigger sense, the people who made it possible for us to be here, and those are our elders and ancestors who fought for our right to be able to be here and talk with one another. You know, it was not all that long ago in this very society, in fact, in this very city, in the history of Chicago and Chicago politics, that if we were to gather in a room and a black male were to get up in front of the room and talk about opening up homes opened by banks and taking them over, someone here would end up dead, or more than one person here would end up dead. And the reason why we're able to have this discussion now today openly and the way that we are is because there are people who are dedicated to fighting for rights. And not for their rights, because they didn't win those rights, but to fight for the rights of those of us who came after them, those who they didn't even know, who they never met, and will never meet. So we're deeply appreciative of those who sacrificed their sweat, blood, and tears, and oftentimes sacrificed their lives in order to make it possible for us to be here in a real way. And it's easy to see then that the reason we're able to be here today is not only because we drove here or took the metro here or how we ended up getting here, not only because there's a group of people who organized this event and made some phone calls and put some flyers and sent out emails, but it's because there was a process that was in place, a struggle that existed that created political space that allowed us then to gather here and talk about the things that we're going to talk about tonight. So it's clear then that if the only reason we're here, the real reason that we're here, is because there was a process and a struggle that allowed us to be here, then we have an obligation to the same process and struggle that allowed us to be here to continue that process, to continue that struggle in order to create further political and human space for the people who are coming after us. If you say you are for something, for someone's rights, or you say you are against a particular action by someone or by a group or by a government, and you are not in an organization that is fighting either for the things you're for or against the things that you're against, then you are not in a real way for the things you're standing for or against the things you're standing for. The reality is no people have ever tripped and accidentally fell into liberation. There has never been an accidental motion in a House of Congress or among dictators who accidentally freed people or accidentally gave people greater rights. The only way we've been able to win rights is by organizing and fighting for the rights that we felt that we deserved and we felt that we needed. And that has been true historically, and that will be true going forward. So if you're interested in advancing rights in this society, in your world, then you have to be a part of your organization that is fighting for the rights that you want to see advanced. It's fighting for the world that you want to see, fighting for the world that you want to live in. And I think there's a tendency in society to equate talking about something with doing something or being about something. But we need to be honest enough with ourselves to say that if all you're doing is talking about liberation, but you're not doing anything about liberation, you're not really for liberation, you're just talking about liberation. So I urge you, there's an ancient saying that goes, if you make a mistake, and you know it's a mistake, and you don't correct the mistake, you just made your second mistake. Mm-hmm. If you are not in an organization that's fighting for the world that you want to live in, I'm telling you now, you made a mistake, and you need to go out and correct that mistake. I think that the idea of being engaged in struggle and having a responsibility towards struggle is true, and it's true all the time, but it's particularly true and particularly meaningful in this time as we are getting deeper and deeper into this economic and housing crisis that is involving us. This economic and housing crisis is bad. It's impacting the growing number of people, and it's getting worse. And what's making it, one of the things that's making it bad is giving it so much attention, is that it's impacting people who normally are not impacted by this kind of crisis. Sorry, what about that? So one thing that's making this crisis so significant in this society is that it's impacting people who are not normally impacted. Quite frankly, it's impacting traditionally middle-class white people in a way and in numbers that these crises normally do not impact. So while this economic and housing crisis is disproportionately impacting low-income people of color, particularly low-income black people, particularly low-income black women, the reality is that it's impacting a much larger swath of the population. It's impacting a much larger number of people than this kind of thing normally impacts. And therefore, because this crisis is growing and it's painful and it's impacting such a large number of people, a growing segment of the population is forced to rethink their relationship to a number of institutions and aspects or segments of the society. Mm-hmm. So as a result of the crisis, as a result of the pain the crisis is causing, people are saying this particular way of doing things doesn't work particularly well, and therefore we may have to think about honestly changing it. A few years ago, the reality is no one said anything when they were able to get a $200,000 loan in order to buy a house that's really worth $100,000, because they all thought they could sell it for $300,000 in 6 months. Well, now that it's clear that this kind of housing boom economic model doesn't work, is not long-term effective, people are starting to question that thing in a way they were not willing to question when they thought they were going to get a big payoff. Nobody complains about the pyramid scheme when it's on the way up. They only complain about it when it's run out and it's on the way down. Nonetheless, the pyramid scheme here has run out and it's on the way down, and people are starting to rethink it. So while this economic crisis is causing a significant amount of pain, a significant amount of suffering, and it's forcing people to rethink their relationship to certain aspects of the society, that presents an incredible and an historic opportunity, really, for the social justice movement, people who want to see the society advance towards greater social justice. And that is, to the extent that people are willing to rethink their relationships to things such as banking institutions, housing, etc., the social justice movement has the ability to come in and present a well-defined, a clearly articulated, and a realistic, achievable alternative in the way that society could potentially work. And then get organized people towards fighting for that alternative rather than for allowing things to continue the way they are or to get worse, to go in the exact opposite direction. So that means, as bad as this crisis is, and as much pain and suffering as it's causing, this crisis is laying the groundwork for us to transform this society in a way that we didn't think was possible just a few years ago. This idea that you have a crisis, and that crisis somehow leads you to being able to transform the society significantly, to turn it into something different, every segment of the society, speaks directly to theories about social change, social transformation, and how that social change and social transformation happens. Every society has contradictions and conflicts, and they happen on a local level, regional level, inside of schools, inside of organizations, etc. Sometimes a society has a crisis which involves the entire society, not just one segment or not just one region, and the crisis becomes so severe that it rises to the level of a real crisis, not just a skirmish or not just a disagreement, but a real crisis. And as a result of this crisis, or in response to the crisis, two or more competing ideas emerge about how to resolve the crisis, how to address it. And then those ideas fight it out in a social clash. And they argue about which way is the best way to address it, and then they fight for their way to dominate. And then at the end of that clash, at the end of that fight, something new emerges in the society, something different. Parts of the society are turned over and operate entirely different. So for example, you could have a society in which you have millions of people who don't have access to health care. And as a result of people not having access to health care, it becomes a full-blown health care crisis. And as a result of the health care crisis, there becomes a clash of ideas about how to deal with or how to resolve the healthcare crisis. And some people say the way you resolve the crisis is by preventing patients from suing. Other people say you resolve the crisis by lowering costs. Some people say you resolve the crisis by allowing the government to have an insurance plan And even others say that the way you resolve the crisis is by making sure that every person, by virtue of the fact of a human being, has full, total, and complete access to health care. And that's the way you solve the health care crisis. And then all of those ideas fight out, and different segments organize, and they try and get it. And then as a result of this clash, something new emerges. Different institutions are turned over, they change the way they work, and something new emerges. Even if it's not what we thought it would happen or the way we want it to happen, something new happens in that particular segment of the society. So there's this, so the way that this particular theory of how social change goes, or social transformation goes, is that you have a crisis. As a result of the crisis, you have a clash of competing ideas on how to resolve the crisis. And then as a result of that clash, you have a new society or a new segment of society that works. A lot of clashes or a lot of contradictions in society are very minor and never result in clash. The United States to date, however, has had three major social clashes. The first social clash we commonly call the Civil War. The crisis was that you had two competing economic systems which are trying to exist inside the same country, which of course you can't. You had slavery on the one hand, and on the other hand you had the burgeoning industrial economy. Industrialization wasn't even established yet, but trying to get a foothold. And those two economic ideas clashed and fought it out about which one should dominate, which one should live here, and which one should live here. And as a result, and that clash really went to its furthest possible, because it became a full-out civil war. And as a result of the full-out civil war, this society changed significantly and changed forever. The slavery ended in the United States, it was legal slavery. It ended in the United States. Industrialization took hold as the new economic system. We had a short period of reconstruction, all kinds of other changes in society happened. Changed the United States forever, for good or for bad, or for different. The second major social clash, we commonly call the Great Depression. The crisis was a complete and total economic meltdown. And the clash was the competing ideas about how to deal with the meltdown, whether to let the industries rebuild themselves or whether to build a social safety net which didn't allow the crash to happen by having people have a net to fall under. And as a result, direct result of labor being able to organize itself and move its agenda forward, we have this society change in a significant way through part of the New Deal. We have Social Security. We had public schools established in a real broad way. We had a 40-hour work week. We had all kinds of change happening to the society. Changed the society forever. The third major social clash was what we commonly call the Civil Rights Movement. And the clash was, in large part, the Civil Rights Movement had many, many parts, and certainly much broader than just the narrow Civil Rights Movement that we think of. But at least in this narrow sense, you had a segment of the black population who was not willing to tolerate the way it was being treated anymore under the laws. And then there was a clash around what the society would look like. Would it be a society that continued along lines of segregation, or would it be a society that had laws that didn't segregate based on race? Again, there were all kinds of other issues at play, all kinds of other things going on. There was a strong anti-war movement. There was a strong women's movement. There was a growing gay, lesbian, and transgender movement. All those things were happening, and all those contributed to the significant changes that we had in the society. As a result of the clash, the society changed significantly, ending segregation law, at least in law, even if it hasn't ended in practice, and ending a whole series of other things and instituting a whole series of new laws in the United States, in the society as well. As a direct result of the current economic and housing crisis here, going on right here in the society, we contend that the U.S. is about to enter into its fourth major social clash. And that fourth major social clash, as a result of the nature and the direction of this particular economic crisis, will be deeply rooted in the issue of land and housing. Millions of people are losing their homes, including large numbers of middle class and white people, precisely the groups that are generally protected from this kind of economic hardship. And so therefore they're rethinking their relationships to land, and they're rethinking ultimately their relationships to housing. So as a consequence of both the scope and the depth of the economic and housing crisis, people are being forced to reconsider their relationships to the financial markets and how they operate, to real estate agents, to bankers, to financial institutions, and to housing itself. For the first time in many, many generations, in a long, long time, at this very moment, banks are reporting record profits on the one hand, and they are executing record numbers of foreclosures on the other. And both are happening simultaneously. And as a direct result of that simultaneous thing happening, people are beginning to ask themselves, what is the definition of a home? What is the meaning of a home? When is it appropriate for a bank that's making millions of dollars of profit while getting billions of dollars of our bailout money to evict people from their homes? And a growing number of people are questioning whether or not that should happen at all. And that's happening directly because of this economic crisis. So these questions that are being raised by people who are suffering under this faulty economic system and who are suffering because of this economic and housing crisis is creating an unprecedented opportunity for social justice movements to reshape and redirect and really transform the society and take it in an entirely new direction. In the seminal work, Wretched of the Earth, France Fanon says that every generation, out of relative obscurity, must discover its mission. And then once discovered, it must either fulfill that mission or betray it. Because of this housing crisis, because of the particular nature of this economic crisis, this generation has a mission. And that mission is, in our lifetime, to elevate housing to the level of a human right. Our mission in our lifetime is to elevate housing in this society to the level of a human right where everyone is granted simply by virtue of the fact that they are human beings. We have the potential to achieve that, and we have a growing movement to try to achieve that as well. And that is our mission, and that's what we should be directing our organizational and individual attention towards. While we have an opportunity, however, to elevate housing to the level of a human right, there's no guarantee that housing will be elevated to the level of a human right. In fact, what happens with the social project is that what the social changes, social transformation can go in any direction. So while we like it to go towards having as a human right, it could just as easily go in the exact opposite direction of giving corporations even greater rights over land and greater rights over housing and greater rights over our lives. Now, I've been saying this for a couple of years now and been saying it in theory, but if you don't understand what that means or don't have practical applications for it, just a couple of months ago, this last month, in fact, I think, the United States Supreme Court announced that corporations have the same right to free speech as human beings do. Corporations are getting greater and greater rights. In New York City, we had a major corporation which bought several thousand units of an apartment complex, bought the place, over-leveraged, paid too much for it, couldn't make the payment, and so just stopped making the payment and walked away from the mortgage. Now, if this were an individual who had done this, they would be vilified as being a deadbeat in the media, to talk about how they're not paying their bills in the media, but instead, this particular company was rewarded, their stock went up, interest in their company went up, because they made a brilliant business move of walking away from the mortgage that they had. It's because the corporations have a greater ability to do things than human beings do at this particular time in this particular society. So there's no guarantee that we're going to move towards or end up in the direction of housing as a human right or human beings having more rights. We could end up in the exact opposite direction. So the way we're going to avoid that is by properly understanding what the time is, what the struggle is, and what we really are fighting for. Right now, confusion is going to be the greatest enemy we have towards making our progress. So we have to clear up some of that confusion to make sure that we don't make some very elementary mistakes. One of the most fundamental confusions that we have to clear up, one of the things that we have to be the most clear about, is understanding or distinguishing between a root issue and a surface issue. A root issue or a surface issue. The root issue or the cause of something, and a surface issue or the things that are on the front. Something that you can touch, something you can feel, something you have to deal with on a daily basis. So we have to make this distinction so that we don't make some very basic mistakes. If you are getting ready to go to a fancy dinner party, and you get all dressed up, and you go on the dinner party, and there's nice food laid out with your friends, and you walk in, and suddenly you realize that your nose is dripping, and your nose is about to start dripping all over your outfit, or dripping all over the food that you're going to eat for all of your friends, of course, you start to panic, and you have to somehow deal with the fact that your nose is dripping. So you get a napkin, you start dabbing your nose, and every once in a while you're dabbing your nose to make sure you're not dripping all over yourself and all over your friends and all over your food. And of course, let me be clear, I'm not advocating that you do not take care of your nose dripping, you do not dab with your napkin. But while you're taking care of your nose and dabbing it with a napkin, you have to do that because you have to deal with the fact that your nose is running and your nose is dripping on this stuff. But while you're doing that, you have to do that understanding that the problem that you're having is not that your nose is running. And so dipping or dabbing at your nose is not solving your problem. Your nose running is only a manifestation of the problem. The real problem is not that your nose is running. The problem is that you're sick, and your sickness is causing your nose to run. And so you can dab your nose, and you need to dab your nose, but theoretically you could be dabbing your nose for the rest of your life because you never actually deal with the root cause of the issue. You're just dealing with the surface issue or the manifestation of the issue. In the 1950s and 60s, in large parts of the country, black people were told by the larger white society that you have to live in this part of town, you can't live anywhere else, this is your area, and this is where you have to go, this is where you have to live. And we're forced to do that. And that was called Jim Crow or segregation laws. And those laws existed in order to force us and manipulate us into doing things that we were being forced to do. As a result of valiant efforts by many, many people, some of who died for their efforts, at the end of the civil rights movement, Jim Crow laws, segregation laws, were wiped off the books, even if segregation continued. The laws themselves were wiped off the books. In the early 2000s, the larger white community was able to come to the black community and say, where you are sitting now is valuable to us. We want you out of there so that we can take the places you live in, build condos there, sell them for $500,000, and move in there ourselves. Okay. And that was the process called gentrification. We're moved out of our community and forced out there. Objectively, there's no difference between someone saying to you, you have to live there, and you have to get out of there. In either case, someone else is telling you where you have to go, and you don't have any power over, you don't have an ability to make a decision about where you go yourself. That's because in the 1950s and 60s, the real problem was not segregation. And recently, in the 2000s, the real problem was not gentrification. The real problem was land, and the lack of control over that land. And the fact is, the extent to which we dealt with segregation in the 1950s and 60s did not deal with, failed to deal with the real issue of land, and therefore we're forced to repeat the issues, to repeat the manifestations of them, even though they were in a slightly different form. And in this recent bout with gentrification, we're also not able to effectively deal with the land question, and as a result, we're going to continue to face the attack for gentrification over and over and over. We cannot continue to deal with only the surface issues, even if we do need to deal with the surface issues. At some point, we have to deal with the root issue, with the root of the problem. Again, the real problem here is land and control over land, not segregation or gentrification, as it were. As we're entering the social clash that we're going to be entering into, the competing ideas about how to resolve the economic crisis, how to resolve the housing crisis, we're going to have to develop the same level of clarity about what is a root issue and what is a surface issue. That's going to require us to rethink things that we think that we understand now or that we are questioning in one way or another. For example, there are competing ideas about what development is. During the housing boom, there was a line in the media, and properly, that development was about building buildings. So if a place could build high buildings with high-speed internet and lights and modern-looking things and glass everywhere and other stuff and new roads, then that was development and that represented development. The reality is, if that is development, this society will go down as the greatest society in the history of mankind. This society has been able to develop things in a way no other society has been able to do. However, If the real meaning of development is about building things, the society is going out as greatest way in the history of humankind. However, if the real meaning of development is not about things, but about human beings, this society has more human beings in prison than any other society in the world, including China, which has four times the population. Society will go down as one of the greatest failures in the history of humankind. This society has figured out how to develop things, but has not yet prioritized the idea of developing human beings. This society is building all kinds of buildings and all kinds of making all kinds of medical advancements, and yet it's cutting back and closing schools. It's having people living in substandard conditions and bombing the hell out of poor countries all across the world. This society has to deal with development on the human level, not just development in terms of things. The same thing has to be said about housing. What is the fundamental purpose of housing? I think most people would think that the fundamental purpose of a house is to provide a home for a family. However, that's not the fundamental purpose of a house in this society. In this society, the fundamental purpose of a house is to serve as a profit center for a financial institution or a speculator. We're going to buy it today and flip it tomorrow by fixing it up or renting out or whatever it is going to do. I think this idea of what the fundamental purpose of development is and what the fundamental purpose of housing is goes right to the core of what the clash, the coming social clash, is going to be about. This coming social clash, I believe, has to do with two rights or competing rights running up against each other, slamming into each other, fighting against one another. On the one hand, you have a right of human beings to have housing, and on the other hand, you have the right of corporations to make a profit. And the two seem to be increasingly mutually exclusive. That if human beings have the right to housing, corporations can't make as much profit as they want, and if corporations are allowed to make the profit they want, then human beings can't have the housing that they want. This class has to be resolved in this society in our lifetime. And as this generation, this society, is going to be judged by the extent to which we deal with that crisis and the answers that we come up with in the way that we deal with that crisis. We assert that the right of human beings to housing supersedes the right of corporations to make a profit. If we have to choose between a human being having a home and a corporation getting to make a few extra $100,000 10 years down the road, we are falling on the side of the human being having the right to a home today rather than a corporation being able to make a profit either today or tomorrow. We wanted to not just put this idea or this assertion in the realm of theory, we wanted to put it in practice. So on October 23rd, 2006, a small group of us, calling ourselves Take Back the Land, identified a vacant piece of land in the Liberty City section of Miami. We arrived on that land, we seized control of it, and we built a shantytown there, which was known as the Emoja Village Shantytown. And we housed ourselves, 150 people, otherwise homeless people in all, on that piece of land by building them shanties where they could live themselves. We didn't ask the government for permission to arrive there. They didn't give us permission. They tried to kick us out. And we provided housing for ourselves in a way the government was unwilling or unable to do. The Emoja Village stood for 6 months. During those 6 months, the residents of Emoja Village, the formerly homeless people who were called that place home, ran the village in a real way. Every Sunday, they had Sunday meetings. They voted on when to build new units, when to no longer build, who got to move in, who had to move out, when the kitchen was open, when the kitchen was closed. They made the rules for their own society. 6 months later, the Emoja Village fell to what we can only call a suspicious fire. We believe it was set by the city, by the government, which was not enough evidence to prove that, but that's what we believe happened. We have a number of reasons to believe that. We can go over, of course. But in the end, we felt like the things which propelled us into seizing that land in the first place and building housing for people who needed housing. By the way, they were going to take that land, that vacant piece of land had been vacant for 8 years. They were going to take it. The city was about to give it away to a developer for free if the developer could prove that it could have enough cash that they could build a condo there in 6 months. This is a low-income black community where no one there could afford it in condos. So we saved that land from being turned into a condo, but we also provided housing for people there. But the same thing that propelled us into creating the Emoja Village in the first place persisted after the fire. So starting in October 2007, we began the process of identifying vacant government-owned and foreclosed homes, opening them up, and moving homeless people into people-less homes. And we've been doing that ever since then. Today, we have moved in 11 families in Miami, and we have done 4 move-ins over the phone, 2 in California, 1 in Nevada, and 1 in Texas. We believe that it is immoral for there to be vacant homes, literally thousands of vacant homes, which are undermining communities because there's no families there, undermining communities because there are vacant structures there, while at the same time there are thousands of people who are looking for homes. This is the worst type of housing crisis. You know, sometimes housing crises used to take place in 1 or 2 forms. In rare cases, you have a city or a society that's built up, and for one reason or another, factory closes or whatever, a bunch of people leave. And so you have homes there, but you don't have enough people to fill the homes. That's one kind of crisis. In the other more common kind of crisis, you have a place, a city, and there are people there, or large numbers of people moving to that city, or the population growth is happening so quickly, but there's not enough homes for all the people who are there, particularly for the low-income people who are there, so people are forced to double and triple. This is the worst kind of, and the most illogical, and the most immoral kind of housing crisis, where you have thousands of empty homes over here, and thousands of people with no place to live over here, and the government sitting in the middle saying, what are we going to do with all these empty homes? And then the very next item on the agenda is, what are we going to do with all these homeless people? And never at any point seemingly making the connection between the two. But we were able to make the connection, and we just took the people and we moved them into the homes. We just did it. Impact the billions of dollars that went into the federal bailout, the bailout of the institutions and the banks. Incidentally, particularly with the home, with the Detroit home over there, the last home that you saw there. But even with the first one that you saw was owned by the Lehman Brothers. Lehman Brothers, of course, the financial system went under, that many people argue triggered this economic crisis that we're in now, but that certainly didn't trigger it. It was just one of the big blocks that fell. Those banks were paid billions of dollars in bailout money. And the way they determined how much bailout money each bank got is the banks had to submit a list of how many foreclosures they had. So they were paid bailout money for the foreclosed homes that we got. So as far as we're concerned, the people, the banks have been paid for those homes already. And the people who are moving into them have a greater right to those homes than the banks do, because they pay taxes and they pay for those homes. Mm-hmm. And the banks have been paid for those homes. Now, our argument is that you can, if you go to a store across the street and you give them a dollar for a drink, they can either take the dollar and give you the drink, or they can already keep the dollar, they can keep the drink. But they can't take the dollar and they get to keep the drink. It's the same thing with the banks. You can't take the money and keep the house. You can have one or the other. Small group of people in Miami, Florida, can somehow turn the tide and transform this society. In October of 2009, the U.S. Human Rights Network, a national network of about 300 organizations who organize and use human rights as a framework for their work on all kinds of different issues, announced a national Take Back the Land movement. And the Take Back the Land movement would not be a singular campaign, not one big campaign, a big national campaign, but rather what we're calling a trans-local campaign, meaning that there are several local organizations that are doing the same thing at the same time in the different communities. And instead of trying to turn that into one big national campaign, we're giving the power to the local campaign, but networking the different organizations in order to make their work more effective and to keep the powers rooted in the communities. We're trying to build a national network of organizations doing Take Back the Land type work. That is, liberating vacant government-owned and foreclosed homes, or defending families who are in homes who are about to get evicted. And we're doing those things, not just to do them, we're doing those things as a means of achieving housing as a human right. And the government is not willing to and able to implement the public policy and the laws that are required to do that, then we are willing to implement our own public policy by moving people to homes ourselves. We are, with the U.S. Human Rights Network, we are calling for a May 2010, in a few months. In May 2010, we're calling for a national month of action, where organizations all across the United States will be engaged in Take Back the Land actions of either liberating housing or defending families that are in foreclosed homes or in public housing. And that not only includes individual homes, but also includes apartments, condos, public housing, vacant land, and any other place where human beings are living. And we feel that human beings have a right to live and deserve to live. And so we're part of a national month of action. We have organizations in 12 cities who are signed up, who are going to be engaging in May 2010 in this national month of action and fighting for the human right to housing. We want to have a critical mass of takeovers and defenses, not just in May, but beyond May. We're doing May because we want to have a month where we have a big splash and do things in a coordinated way, some level of coordination in a big way. The reality is, this is not going to be one in May. If you think you're going to enter the struggle, it's going to happen from May 1st to May 31st, it's going to be over. You have another thing coming. This is going to be a protracted struggle, because we're not just fighting for any of those things. But we are in the, through the civil rights movement, people felt that they had a right to sit on the bus wherever they wanted, because they paid the same amount of money as everyone else did on that bus. And so they have sit-ins in buses and restaurants and stuff. We just certainly don't have to choose between the two. We don't want to choose the two. We're not trying to make the two. We're not trying to minimize the importance of one or the other. But clearly, being able to live somewhere is far more significant, has a far greater impact on someone's life than sitting where you want to on the bus. So in the spirit and inspired by what happened in the 50s and 60s, in the civil rights movement, the sit-ins, we're organizing in May 2010 a national, a trans-local series of live-ins, where we have people live, move in, and stay in homes so that they have the right to live there instead of having banks keep empty homes. The cruel irony here is that you have thousands of people who need homes and don't have any, and you have banks, corporations who don't need homes to live, who don't need homes to survive, who have thousands of homes that have nothing to do with them. They can't sell them, and they can't live in them. And we want to balance out that equation. The way we're going to balance out the equation is by fundamentally changing or transforming land relationships in this country. We cannot continue to have land relationships that exist in a way that a few people can gather up a large number of housing and then others don't have a right to housing. So we'll end homelessness. We have lots of discussion to wrap back forth. We have lots of discussions about what causes homelessness and what is the cause of homelessness, and we don't understand what the cause of homelessness. The cause of homelessness is very simple. The cause of homelessness is that someone doesn't have a home. The Emotion Village, we had a resident there who became a good friend of mine. His name is Ronnie Holmes. And Ronnie Holmes, in his mid-20s, became a drug addict. He was addicted to cocaine. And so he struggled with it. He's a brilliant, brilliant guy. And he did a lot of great work at Emotion Village. He became addicted to cocaine, and he started stealing money from his house. And he ended up getting himself and his family in a lot of trouble. And he became homeless. He had a drug addiction, and he spent all kinds of money. And then, after spending all that money, including money that wasn't his, his family was foreclosed and evicted from their home, and then he became homeless. I want to be clear that he didn't become homeless because he had a drug addiction problem. He became homeless because the family ran out of money and was not able to pay a mortgage and therefore kicked out of the house. To show you why there's not a direct correlation between being drug addicted and becoming homeless. In his 1920s, George W. Bush became addicted to cocaine. But the difference between George W. Bush and Ronnie Holmes, not that George W. Bush is smarter than Ronnie Holmes, I'm sure he's not the case, but George W. Bush had a wealthy father. His wealthy father was able to absorb the losses that he gave. So Ronnie Holmes became homeless because he didn't have a wealthy father who was the head of the CIA at the time. And so if everyone had a wealthy father who was the head of the CIA, then no one would be homeless, and everyone would be free to be drug addicted. Homelessness is not drug addiction or mental health. It is not having a home. We can end homelessness by allowing people to have homes rather than allowing banks to have homes and have individuals owning multiple homes when others don't have them. When a social contract breaks down, this is that theory of a social contract, that people get together in a society and say, look, we have common needs, and we have common things we have to do. We all want to get down the street, so we're going to together pool our money and build a road. All of us have children, want to get them to go to school, so we're going to pool our money and build a single school, rather than each of us building 50 separate schools. And we're going to use some common resources. That's a social contract. We have a social contract to run the society in a particular way, to do things to meet certain needs for our population, including meeting the needs of people who don't have as much as those who are on the top of that society. When the social contract breaks down, it breaks down and certain parts of society don't work anymore. But when certain parts of society don't work anymore, that doesn't alleviate our responsibility to one another. If we all agree that we need to build this road, and we gave someone the money to build the road, and they stole the money to build the road, we still have to build the road, because we still need to get down the street. In the same way, the social contract breaks down because the people who are given the money to take care of poor people is not taking care of poor people. They're instead handing that money over to banks. That doesn't mean that we have alleviated ourselves our responsibility to people who need help. We still have a responsibility to our brothers and sisters who need help. Towards each other is greater now than it is when we have a social contract, because we can't just write a check and walk out of the room. We have a greater obligation towards one another today than we did before. The only way we're going to have people have housing and correct this gross economic crisis is by being engaged in a struggle to change, to transform the society in a fundamental and significant way by transforming land relationships and by elevating housing to the level of human rights. And the only way we're going to do that is by joining organizations that are actively engaged in the struggle to see housing develop into a human right. Here, everyone of good conscience, to join an organization that's fighting for that. The Chicago Anti-Eviction Campaign is part of the Take Back the Land Network, and we'll be engaging in Take Back the Land type work in the next several months, in the time frame that makes sense for the campaign, not in the time frame that makes sense for us. And we urge you to get involved with them. If that's not the organization through which you want to or can do your work, then you have an obligation to create your organization and join the organization that will do that. Join the fight for housing as a human rights force.
Yeah, I'm a good trainer. felt lonely doing this work. We don't pass for loneliness, but it's astounding that it resonates, right? Who's ever felt isolated doing this work? You try harder and harder, you dig deeper and deeper, and you find yourself in a hole all by yourself, right? So, when I grew up outside D.C., when I was 18 years old, I was part of an organization called Homes Not Jails, 10 years ago. And we used to move into homes, fix them up, hand them over to homeless families as a way to get them from 10-year waiting list on Section 8 up to the top of the list. Because when you take over a house, suddenly there's no one in front of you, right? And when I moved to Chicago in 2003, I joined an organization called the Latino Union, which was working with day laborers who had been sick and tired of looking for work on the street corner. And so they took over an abandoned bus terminal owned by the city of Chicago to turn it into a worker center and demand from the city that the city provide them with a space so that they could control the conditions of their own labor with the employers who were looking for them in the residential construction industry, right? So what we see today was Chicago and the eviction campaign would take back the land with the 12 other cities. It's not just people stepping up in bigger and better ways in their own cities, but they got a phone network for this too, right? You heard that? He said, we take over the houses by phone now. You call Max and it's like, for alleged trespassing, dial 5. For a blockade when the sheriff comes to your door, hit 9. That's amazing. What also is amazing is that we do this not just because we hate the way things are, but because we love our people, right? We're filled with a love for our people and a rage at the way that things are. And those two things motivate us to have a hope to believe that another world is possible, right? And that's the banner that we organize under as the U.S. Social Forum, which is a gathering of about 20,000 changemakers happening 5 hours from here in June in Detroit this summer.
That's right.
And Detroit knows empty houses like nobody's business.
Right?
And Detroit learned from Atlanta, where they had the first U.S. Social Forum. People gathered, we did our thing, we left, and Atlanta was tired. Atlanta was still trying to figure out where the bathrooms were going to go, right? And Atlanta didn't get to make the leap locally that they thought they could have when they had all these changemakers come. And Detroit, because it's in the Midwest, and you know how we go down in the Midwest, said, you all aren't coming here. New York's not coming here to tell us how to lead a movement, right? The Bay Area is not coming here to tell us how to lead a movement. We're the center of the country. We're the center of a movement, right? So if we have 60,000 empty houses in Detroit, and we have 30,000 homeless people in Detroit, we're going to give the movement and we're going to give the city of Detroit a math lesson. Because we're not going to bring 20,000 changemakers and call it a success unless at the end of those 5 days, on June 26th, everyone is formerly homeless and has a winter home and a summer home in Detroit.
Wow.
So people are stepping up in big ways in Chicago because just because Detroit is the host city, the whole Midwest is the host, right? Which means that Chicago, as the city that holds down the Midwest, is the co-host of the U.S. Social Forum in Detroit. Is that right?
Yeah.
So you have the Chicago Anti-Eviction Campaign organizing a rack of folks to join up with about 150 people or so from Miami. Is that right?
Those are the numbers I heard so far.
The immigrant worker organizations in Chicago are sending a worker delegation. Stop, the Chicago Freedom School, ICA, a whole rack of people are sending at least 200 youth from Chicago. And we're going to be joined by San Antonio from New Orleans, from Atlanta, in a People's Freedom Caravan coming up from the South. We got indigenous organizers starting in Seattle on the Red Road to Detroit. We got the Mid-Atlantic Caravan. I just found out today there's a Louisville Caravan. And so this is our moment. Max is talking about a social clash. This is a moment for us to be stepping out in bigger and better and badder ways than we ever have, right? So we have folks stepping out from Mississippi, walking to Detroit, on a Delta to Detroit march. And so if they're willing to walk from Mississippi to be in Detroit to make another world possible, I hope that you all will be willing to hop in a car, drive 5 hours in a caravan, and see what we can do this summer, and then come back and make Chicago the city that we all want to live in.
Okay, so B just got telling us a little bit about some of the ways
different folks all across the country are coming out to the U.S. Social Forum, right? And the U.S. Social Forum is supposed to be a place where folks with social movements, right, who are stepping forward are coming together, right? So it's not just for nonprofit organizations. It's not for nonprofit organizations. It's not for the corporations. It's for people to come together and figure out ways to solve their problems, right? Mm-hmm. So since we're all here together, what questions do you have, right? What questions do you have for Matt? What issues do you want to put on the table in terms of how we can go about doing this and really get this thing moving?
Wait, hold on.
Yes,
this young lady who's been waiting for a
while.
Okay.
What are you
going to do
like that? What are you always protesting me?
I know. Hi, my name is Cynthia Ashley. I'm a war member of Stop Suffering Together, Organizing Power. We are a strong organization, and we fight for it's saying about, you know, housing. All right, it won't for Stop. You know, I stay on Cali Grove from 16th to 63rd. They're going to foreclose and bait and get people to take their options. Stop came around, met with the person I met in the house, he had beer and everything. He came out. That's my good baby. But, I was begging him up all the way. And you need that beggar, you know. You have to get people involved. Or if people don't get involved yet, I get frustrated, believe me. I get frustrated. Especially someone tell me, oh, I'm going to do this since here. I'm going to do that. I'm going to go again. I'm stuck here at the last minute. You know, going to, you know, by myself. Yes. Hospitals and human rights, we won't go without a fight. That's why I get frustrated when I don't have that bag up like it's supposed to have. It's because we have I'm on the board of directors of board member stop, I'm board of director, I'm qualified secretary for Grove Park Tennis Association. I'm a member of the design committee for Grove Park and relocation. Partly now a member, I used to be a member of SHINE. You know, I like to get involved, you know, get involved, you know, be involved. To be involved is to stay involved. Stay involved is to be involved. You know, death go together. You know, okay, so what if 800-something people stay across the street? If you don't want to come to the meeting, let it be. You know, just let it be. You know, and I'm trying to work on it, you know, because I have issues. Not a crazy issue, Deborah. I have an issue, you know, especially because I put my own into it, you know.
I said we all got issues, so don't worry about it.
You know, we talk about this social forum. Yes, that's going to happen in June.
Like her BK, man, 60,000 vacant homes, 30,000 homeless people. Let's make a statement when we get there. We went into the last social forum, and we built several national movements. Like Matt said, get this. We don't know, we built several national housing movements. This time, because this is what Chicago set trend, we have a responsibility to take some solutions to Detroit and not the problem. Let's do some anti-eviction blockades and take some success stories around anti-eviction blockades. Let's do some liberation and take some success stories. Let's take success to Detroit and not a problem. And I hope that we can find the space, at least with the anti-eviction campaign, to combine our movements and get them solutions to the table in Detroit so that people are not just protesting a problem, but working around solutions.
Yeah, how you doing? My name is Joseph Peary. The fellow just spoke, Willie, asked me to get up to speak on, some of you might remember me from before, maybe about 25 years ago. We started an organization called the Homeless Union, Chicago Area Union of the Homeless. And we did basically what you're doing. Did it for like about a 7-year period. Went into public housing, knocked down the doors, even got unions to come in and fix the place up. Move families in, get the news media down there, and basically say, we're a bunch of poor people that have nothing, and we just did this. Mm-hmm. We just moved people. There's like 7,000 vacant apartments at that time in public housing. And we're able to move something like 25 families in to some of those. It got so bad that, you know, with the, you see, the coldest day of the year, 78 below zero, with a wind chill factor. Here's a family out on the streets, a grandmother and children, and it goes over the Chicago Airways. It got so bad with the phones at City Hall that they couldn't take it. And what they ended up doing was, instead of them wanting to tear down public housing in 1996 and moving everybody out, but they finally moved us out of Cabrini in 2005-2006, we were able to buy ourselves another 10 years with the struggle that went on. And I'm glad you brought up in your talk about drugs, because if there's anything that they whooped us with, it was the drug thing. Most of our members, probably like 90% of our members, were folks who either were involved in selling drugs or using drugs, and it turned this around, being involved in the movement, being involved in the struggle. All of a sudden, we look up, there's free drugs everywhere, there's people coming at us from every direction, and that's how they destroyed our movement, Chicago Area Union of Homeless, which was a national thing at the time, the Union of the Homeless, the National Homeless Union. I'm still here. A lot of the folks that I remember you. I forgot your name.
Mark.
Yeah. Peace to Mark's with us. Take over homes with us. I want to acknowledge a few people in the room. Shalana, could you stand up? Shalana McIntosh. Will you stand up?
My name's J.R.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Security name out there. He ain't like that.
Right. Well, I've known all three of these individuals since they were kids.
Talking about hand over there.
I'm sorry, hear me. Shit. Hey, man, don't throw a rock over here. I'm sorry. But we had a youth center in Cabrini, and part of what I did at that time while I was doing the homeless organizing was working with youth, and united those two things together. It's very powerful. We had young people that were involved, and I'm just so happy that these young folks, nowadays, 25 years later, 20 years later, are involved in the struggle. And you can see the fruits of that. I think what's different between now and back then when we were doing our organizing is that right now, all that stuff you just stated, I've never seen so many middle-class people walking around, waiting at bus stops in the middle of the night, wrapped up in sleeping bags with nowhere to go, and got no chance of ever getting a job again. How many of them? That means this is no solution for them, you know, as a reform. It ain't there. It ain't going to happen. These are folks that got nothing to do but fight. And it's out there for us if we go out there and organize.
Yeah.
Every single person in this room needs to join this and become an organizer. And not just that. We need to educate ourselves, each one, teach one. If we can do that, then you won't end up like I did 25 years later, basically, you know, a couple years back, and looking like, wow, this is pretty horrible. George Bush, president. War's going on. I mean, it's looking awful bad, right? you know, now it's kind of looking good. You get a room full of people that want to organize. Look, let's learn from our mistakes from the past. Mm-hmm. Everybody in this room, educate yourself. Educate all the other people you can. Organize. Agitate. Because power is not going to respect anything but the numbers. And the numbers are there. Let's go get them. All right?
Just one old dude, got to call another old dude. My name is Roger, I'm from South. And there, the fighters in Kentucky was one, doing great work over on the South side throughout the city. I really want to commend Max on the Sullivan analysis. Makes me feel good. You know, I started in this struggle back in the middle of the 60s. And to see the young people coming forth with analysis like that tells me that everything is just fine. just want to comment on a couple of things I think that he said in the course of the discussion that were very important. And the first thing I want to say is that we're living in a very important time, as he described. We're living in a period of revolutionary change. That is, this is a period where one day makes 20 years, where the other period, where it takes 20 years to make one day. This is a period where one day makes 20 years. And when he makes the appeal and the call, and as J.R. said, this is a very important time that we don't go somewhere just to be there, but that we bring something with us called success, called victory, and examples where other people can learn from. And that's what I hope we take to the social forum. Victories are how we put people back into their homes here in Chicago, and how we have shown the way and what's possible here in Chicago. The other thing I want to say that I thought was so important in terms of the focus of his analysis on the question of land and on the question of housing. I'd like to take one step further, that the question today that confronts us is the question of property. You know, the question of whether or not, you know, people are being deprived of the right to existence because of the monopolies the corporations want to have in changing everything into private property. I mean, I think he puts on the table a very fundamental question that not only housing, but healthcare, all the education, all the things we're fighting for today are human rights without question. And that's the way there's nothing to debate on that. So I'm certainly going to do everything he say, and I know the doctor is going to be right up front, and we're going to make the social forum a real turn in that part.
Question about squatting. Is there like a list of foreclosed homes in Chicago? Or would I have to go downtown to get that information to like City Hall or something?
So I don't know, maybe someone knows this in Chicago in particular, but their most counties have websites.
Yeah.
And they list in the county website, they list the foreclosures. But
okay.
They usually make it very difficult to go through because the county sells over there. And of course they're not going to be able to sell it, and effectively they give it away for free, so they make it very difficult to go through. But also getting subscriptions to Reality, to Realty Track,
okay.
And other things, or other subscription services, they give you a list of foreclosures that exist in the community.
Okay, also, if the building is completely gutted, like there's no fuses or anything, and like, I mean, it's winter right now, I mean, like, I'm not going to say who, but I know people who are squatting, and, like, they don't have heat or anything, so, like, what's something that they could use besides, like, fire, because there's, like, lots of fiberglass, like, stuff in the building that they're in, it's just, like, an old abandoned factory. Like, what's something that you could use to use?
So, with the National, we have not taken a position yet on something like that, but we took Take Back the Land Miami. We established a set of criteria for the families that we moved in and for the homes into which we moved them. So for the families that we moved in, we only moved families into homes that were either government-owned or foreclosed. Hmm. So we found a place that was empty and just sitting around and whatnot, but it was owned by someone who lived down the street or on the block or whatever. We would not move anyone in there. That was off our list. We only had places that were government-owned or foreclosed. And then we only moved people into places that were in good condition. Couldn't have any holes in the ceiling, couldn't have any, you know, holes in the floorboard or anything like that. And have to have the capacity for running electricity and running water.
Okay.
And if we didn't have the capacity for that, we wouldn't move them in, because we were trying to accomplish, and we are trying to accomplish, something on at least three levels. One is we're trying to help the family that we're moving into a place, by moving them into a place, in a decent place. The second is we're trying to strengthen the community into which we're moving them. And that means that communities can't be strengthened, can't be strong, if they're empty. Mm-hmm. It really undermines the idea of community. If you go to like Main Street in Miami, you drive down and then there's 5-6 empty units on a block, it's really difficult to call that a community when there's half the streets, half the houses are empty. So we're trying to strengthen the community. And that meant also, as part of that, that we had to move in families that were willing to be good neighbors. So we had to interview the families and make sure they were willing to be good neighbors. We don't want to move someone in there as the neighbors that end up doing more damage to the neighborhood than they do good in a particular way. And then the third thing we're trying to build is to build a movement. And we felt like we couldn't build a movement by moving the family into a place, and then if the media goes there, they see children running around in a place with no electricity and no running water. So we would not have moved the family into that particular place. Now, with that said, we've been trying to engage the services of engineers and of people who are into the green forms of rebuilding and electricity and other things, in order to find out if there are ways that we can pick places that are not, right now don't meet our conditions, but could meet our conditions with, you know, some alternative ways of doing things. So there's one home that we moved the family into. It was in very good condition, but it had been empty for about a month or so. And so people broke in, you know, people were desperate and need money, and they opened up the fixtures like this, and they pulled out all the copper wiring, yeah. And it sold the copper. So the place didn't have electricity. So we got a nonprofit, and we convinced them to purchase and donate to us a solar panel. And the family then used solar panels to have electricity. So I think probably one way would be to do solar panel or to do wind turbine. And of course, there are kits for that that you can get over the internet.
Okay.
When we had the Emotion Village, the other thing that we did is, of course, we were in the middle of a field. We had an apartment complex next door with neighbors that were very close to, but we had to find alternative ways of doing things. So we had a garden, and we grew our own food, which is much easier for us to get here around anyway than it is here. We had a garden, we grew our own food. We dug a well, so we pumped our own water on the property. And we're experimenting with all kinds of different things. We had a TV there, and sometimes we plug it into neighbors, but we had a bike that we bicycled so we could keep the TV. So I think things like that, having human power and electricity, I think would be a significant part of that, also. So I think you need to think about, organizations need to think about what their rules are for the places that they want to move people into. Right. And you may get to a place, you may say, this doesn't meet our criteria.
Right.
But I think there's also going to be an incredible possibility here to merge two, to kill two birds with one stone, to merge two areas of our life which are clashing into each other, being forced together, and one is providing people with housing, and the other is providing housing or providing people with decent standards of living in a way that doesn't destroy the planet. Meaning some alternative forms of electricity, alternative forms of water running, alternative forms of food sources.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you have to deal with arrests at all, and are there any strategies being dealt with in your particular area or nationally for making sure folks are maybe particularly vulnerable to having harsh consequences if they carry a record with them or moving into these places?
So we generally do, we show two videos here, but we generally, we do liberations, which is the main thing that we do more so than defenses. When we do liberations, we generally do so surreptitiously. No one knows, we don't bring cameras. Most of the families that we've had move in have not been willing to do media. And our responsibility is towards the family as well as to the thing. In fact, when we started, we had two objectives that we were trying to accomplish. One was to house people. And the other was to force, heighten contradiction, force this conversation, force this debate in the society. What we didn't realize at the time was that the two objectives were mutually exclusive. If we wanted to have family over a long period of time, we couldn't let anyone know they lived there. And if we wanted to start a social conversation, we could only do so by showing the family who was there. Mm-hmm. So that just created a very unusual situation for us. We had two instances in which families had been found, one in which they were found, which was the first video that you saw. And the second was in which it was a very different situation where family was evicted from their home, and we took them and we moved them right back into the same home from which they were evicted, which was the first time we did that. At that point, both of those instances, it didn't make any sense to continue to keep where they were located a secret. It made no sense at all. In fact, it could have been harmful to them. We have not had any arrests, and we haven't had any families moved out by the police. Now, we have had a couple of families without eviction notice. And generally speaking, what happens is, in every case except for those two, when the family gets to know that they've already been in the place for 6 months, they saved up their money, and they already have a security deposit, they're ready to move to the next place. Mm-hmm. And in two instances, not the family saved money, but also because the bank had to go through the eviction process, which could cost a lot of money, it could be between $5,000 and $10,000, the bank offered the family $1,000 to move quietly rather than go through the eviction process and the family leave. So we have not had any arrests. In the two instances where we had the police come, both of those, we were there with at least 20 people in each. In the second one, the Shorty family, the second one, we saw that family, and the day that we moved them in, that was featured in the Michael Moore movie, Captains of a Love Story. But if you saw the movie, then you know the police arrived, came up, argued with us, huddled up, and got in their car, and never came back. There's a couple of reasons why that is in Miami, which may not necessarily apply to New York. Miami has one of the worst housing prices in the United States, and people in Miami generally seem to think that, and I think accurately so, that the government has something to do with the housing crisis. And particularly there was a series of articles that came out by local media talking about how they were, the government officials were taking money specifically geared towards low-income housing in the middle of housing crisis and spending it on all kinds of crazy things. So one example, they took they commissioned some art, and instead of paying for the art from the art budget, they took it from the low-income housing budget. And they spent something like $100,000 on an 8-foot-tall watermelon sculpture. And then, of course, when this was found out, then they did a, let's call it, reassessed the value of the art, and it was assessed at like $3,000. So it wasn't worth assessing. In another instance, one of the more egregious instances, a developer got money to build low-income housing. Got, I think, $8 million to build low-income housing. So this developer had never built a single house before in his entire life. Wasn't actually a developer. And building low-income housing is a special skill, so you can't just, whatever. So with the $8 million, the developer built, this is low-income housing, but he built one house. One house that he made up. The worst part is that the house he built was his own house. Bedroom, whatever.
He can't
do anything. Throughout all this, only one arrest was made. I mean, clearly there was millions of dollars stolen. So I think it would have been very difficult politically that the police recognized and the elected officials recognized. It would have been extremely difficult politically for them to not arrest the people who were causing homelessness, but then turn around and arrest the people who were trying to resolve the crisis. So I think we put them in that position, very intentionally so, and we forced them in a position where they had a very tough decision to make, and we think they made the right decision. Hey,
Max, what is the turnaround time for an individual from the time you meet with them to get to the home? It depends on where
they're going. Changes from time to time with the Shorty family. Mm-hmm. It was, we met them on a Thursday, we moved them in on a Monday. Right. It's different times with different families, it just depends on the situation.
So with that particular situation, the utilities weren't interfered with water.
No, they weren't off. We do, one of the things we require the families that they turn the utilities off. They have to be able to, if a family isn't able to turn on the utilities, we don't do that. So they have to be able to.
Well,
if
you have a
young
lady in the back, she's going to have her hand up for a ride.
I have two questions. My question is there a particular reason why you all only go after government-owned homes or
foreclosed? We do government-owned and foreclosed. Either one. So that's public housing, but also there's other government housing that's not considered public housing, even though in a real sense it is. And we do it for a couple of reasons. One is that internally, that's the only thing that we had real consensus on. So we could all imagine situations where an individual owned a home, and we'd be willing to move someone into there. But we also imagine situations where the individual owned a home and we would not be willing to move there. So, like, for example, one of the people who supports our organization takes care of her mother. Her mother moved out of her house. She has Alzheimer's, she's in her late 80s, And so her house has been vacant for 2 or 3 years. It's her mother's house. Her mother owns it outright. No one lives there. We would not take over that house. Mm-hmm. She lives less than a mile away. It's a woman with Alzheimer's. We wouldn't feel comfortable doing that. And the reality is, because we don't get any funding, we don't have the staff, we don't get space for what we do. We don't have the ability to do the amount of checking that we need to do, then come back and say, is this a house you want to move into? Mm-hmm. There's so many foreclosed homes, why are we going to mess around with it?
Plus, because of the stimulus package, they're our homes in.
Right, exactly. Let's keep an emphasis on that. While we're at this point around the anti-eviction blockade and these takeovers, the government spent billions of dollars of taxpayers' money to bail out the bank. In the same sense of mind, we were privileged to be part of a conversation last month with the head of housing. They're going to privatize every public housing unit in this country, including the unidentified public housing stock, which are the foreclosed properties that they bought back from the bank. They're going to turn them back over to the bank. You bail them out with the money, and now you give them the homes back. Not under our watch. That's what we say. Not under our watch. You're going to stick me up twice.
Your second question?
The second question.
Well,
my second because I'm a new college. I'm trying to find ways to work within this organization. My second question is trying to find a solution to the problem. Do you all try to find, I'm thinking too big maybe, but just the regular homes. Do you all try to find ways to help families in a situation to try to buy homes that they're losing or eventually going to become a bigger thing? Like, I guess, trying to find, some type of solution to the problem.
Right. So we don't do that, and there's two reasons why we don't do that. First of all, because there's a lot of other organizations and private companies that do that already. And so we think that different organizations can and should have different roles. We don't think that every organization in the United States should be doing what we're doing. We think there should be organizations who are helping people prevent foreclosure. There should be organizations that help people fix their credit score. There should be organizations that help people do all kinds of different things. That's what they do, and that's fine. That's not what we do, however. We don't think there's no shortage organizations doing that. You can find them all over the place, in the phone book, on the internet. There's a big shortage of organizations who are doing what we do. And so that's why we can find what works for us to do. The second thing, but more importantly, I think in terms of the bigger picture of why we're doing what we're doing, is because we are not trying to help one family keep their home. We're trying to change the way land relationships work in the United States. And that's entirely different. It's an entirely different thing. And in order to do that, of course, we have to help individual families. We can only want to do that. Of course, ultimately, we want to do is help millions of people do that by changing the way land relationships work. But we think that our job, Take Back the Land's job, we only do two things. We move people into houses, and we defend them when the police come. That's all we do. So if someone comes to us and says, we don't have enough money to pay our bills, we say, call so-and-so or do this. We don't do that. We don't get funding for what we do either. So the people who get paid to help people with their paperwork, we don't get paid for that. We're trying to build a movement to change land relationships in this country and to elevate housing to the level of a human right. That's what we're trying to do. And we should stay very narrowly focused on that. I want, when I have a fire at my house, I don't want the accounting company coming and putting out the fire. Let the fire department put out the fire. And in the same way, if you need help with your mortgage, fixing some things up, you should hire some professionals or get some professionals to do that. But if you have nowhere to stay and you're willing to challenge land relationships in this country, then we want to help do that.
Money that you can while that's happening. Don't try to pay it off. And when it goes to auction, buy each other's houses and keep it.
you said if you're going into a community, you know, that houses here and there or that are empty, it's clearly the benefit of people who are living in that community still to have a stock to buy, as you said. So I'm wondering how you have approached maybe talking to the neighbors to say, look, we're going to be moving your family in that story, you know, we want you to support that. Yeah. And, you know, in terms of kind of rebuilding that community, also the people that are moving into the home being part of that. I just wonder how you approach that, or if you approach that specifically, what that looks like.
So we talked about a little bit about what we, the criteria that we have for the homes that we move people into. So we talked about some of the criteria we have for the people that we move into the home. They have to be able to turn on the electricity and the water, so they're not able to do that. And they have to, among other things, they have to help clean up the house. So we don't require anybody from them. We don't accept any money from them. But they have to come help clean up. And so when we go there to move them in, and it's, you know, clean up time, they don't show up to clean up, we close the door and we leave. We don't, that's what they paid to do there, to be there. And then the and one of the other major things is we require them to be good neighbors. And we require them to be good neighbors because we are trying to strengthen the community, not just us. And so part of requiring them to be a good neighbor is before we move them in, we take them around and we introduce them to the neighbors we live next to. Now, we don't always explain to the neighbors exactly what's going on. We like to have one neighbor, at least, who knows exactly what the situation is. And we have had that in about half the cases, maybe a little bit less, even four or five cases out of 11 where we had the neighbors know what was going on. But we think that an integral part of building community is people knowing each other and people respecting each other. We tell them when they move in, every time you see your neighbor, say good morning, say good evening, they need a cup of sugar, give them a cup of sugar, because in the end, the thing that's going to allow them to stay there is not us, because we can't respond 5 minutes notice if the police show up there. It's going to be their neighbors. And the reality is, if the police come and the media come and the neighbors are saying, these are horrible people, we'll get them out of here, we want them in, the police are going to put them in the car, they're going to drive away, and the neighbors are going to be clapping. Conversely, if they're a good neighbor there, and the neighbors think that having that family in there makes more sense than having a house open that could do, first of all, about providing them social good, but also then is creating a dangerous situation for the neighborhood, then when the police come, the neighbors are going to insist that the police leave them there, and the neighbors will stand up and fight for that family's right to stay there as well. So we think that the neighbors understanding and understanding what's going on is critical. We think that's going to grow. We think that's going to be a much bigger part of it going forward. And in terms of defenses, we think that we're going to have areas where entire communities are organized around the idea that no one from this block gets evicted. So they come to evict anyone, the whole neighborhood comes out, and we defend our neighbor.
Specifically in Miami.
In Miami, we have a group of five people, and we make decisions collectively. We make decisions by consensus when possible. If it's not possible, we try very hard not to beat our heads against the wall over and over. We just take a vote from the simple majority. But most of the time, we're able to make decisions by consensus.
And it's always calling families.
I'm sorry?
Is it always you're always following families lead?
No, we're not always following families lead. But there could be times where there's a contradiction between what the family wants and what we might want. The families who want us to move in a place because they're desperate for a place, in a place where we don't feel comfortable moving them into, and so we don't necessarily want to do that. Sometimes we have to work the family to make them and help them understand how important it is being a good neighbor. How significant of a component being a good neighbor is. People don't always necessarily understand that because in this country in particular, we don't have a history of building neighborhoods in the same way we do in some other countries. So I mean, that is also significant. I think the other thing is that the reality is we don't think that at the end of this crisis, let's say we get, what does victory mean? Let's say we win. What does that mean? We think at the end that means that we have large numbers of homes handed over to a community land trust that controls the land. We don't think that the natural conclusion to this campaign is that each individual is family to get the homes individually. That wouldn't necessarily make sense. Now, of course, if you give the family that option, that's of course what most people are going to want. They don't want the house to themselves. And of course, they want to go in, they want to call the bank and negotiate that themselves. We are not going to stop them, we're not going to debate them, and we're not going to not try to undermine them. But we want to talk about the bigger picture, about the movement that they are part of. So there are times you could have conflicts, but we make decisions. Now, with that said, the decisions that are central to the families' well-being, we need to have them make them. So when they're found there, when the bank comes or the police comes, they find them, we take the families, and we tell them, look, here are your actions. You can leave, you can negotiate with the bank, and then leave, or you can stay and fight. And we want you to stay and fight, but it's not our decision, it's your decision. Most of the families have chosen to leave. So we don't feel like we can force them, we don't want to force them to stay and to fight when they're not ready to do that. So that part is their decision. We try to make it clear, we try to negotiate on their behalf if they want us to. We have rarely gotten our way ever. We want to have this showdown. We want them to come. We want them to get dragged away from the house and create another empty house in the neighborhood. We dare them to.
Question?
Yeah, I was just wondering when you spoke about the land trust as well as the idea that they've already been paid for by the bailout money. Is that like a legal possibility in terms of that, like a legal choice that could be had? Or?
I don't think it's a legal possibility. I do think it's a political possibility. And I'll tell you where the political possibility lies. Right now, we have many nonprofits have, of course, approached banks about just that things moment. Some have done so in some limited way just to get rid of the ones that they don't want. And of course, the nonprofits always complain that the banks get rid of the crap house that they have, not any of the good ones, and they're just going to sell it there. But the reality is, if we were to go up to a bank now, the Citibank or the Bank of America, or any of these that got business out, say, look, you have business out, you have all these empty houses you're not selling, you've got families in your house. Give us a house, take the tax write-off, we'll pay for some of them, you know, whatever. The banks would lack in people's space. And this happened when the bailout happened. Legally, of course, they can hand it off, but they have no reason to. And the reality is, the social justice movement is not in a position to negotiate with the banks any differently. Now, if we go, let's say May happens, and then we do the same thing again another time over the summer and over the fall, and then at the end of that, we go back to Citibank and back to Bank of America and say, look, we now have under our control 10,000 of your homes. Let's negotiate now. I think we'll be in a very, very different position, and that's where I think that will come from.
No, I have a person, Chairman Bank. A lot of the cities of the homeless population heavily oppressed, abused, and victimized, and would not constitute what one would call good neighbors. That is, wouldn't anybody lose. I mean, that's a large part of the social struggle. I mean, how does a movement constitute that?
So for us in Miami, we do not move in individuals. We only move in families.
Right.
And we require, again, the families to be good neighbors. And that requires a number of things. But one of the things that it requires is the ability to say, I'm going to be a good neighbor. So that means if that ability is compromised, that means we do not move in people with drug addiction or severe mental health issues, which are both stereotypical and also typical of much of a homeless population. Let me just make it clear, we did not come to that decision very easily. Mm-hmm. That was one of our longest and biggest decision-making process, and that's one, I don't think we reached that one a consensus, I don't remember exactly. That was very difficult because we think that everybody has a right to housing, even those communities who have either drug addiction or mental health issues. I think our argument is housing more than another street. Well, we realized we couldn't build a movement that way specifically because of that, and if we moved in a family or moved in an individual, and then the neighbors started complaining, and they associated our moving them in with the problem that they started having and anything after that happened, then we felt like we couldn't build a movement that way. So we'd be helping one individual, but we wouldn't be either helping the community or helping unless we had the capacity to help that individual become a good neighbor, and we didn't have the capacity.
So that was a tactical.
Yes, that was a very difficult one. I want to make it, we weren't happy about coming to that conclusion.
Well, how do you, given your experience, how does a movement encompass that? Because that's what it's about. I mean, in my view, the question of the poor, I mean, there's always been marginal, and this is true, the new middle class, but this is a question where people are being dispossessed, and they're put in a position that the movement has to encompass that segment of the population.
Yeah.
Now, when I say that, that is no way compromising what you're doing.
Right.
That is true. But the question still remains. I mean, in terms of the struggle, it is a class struggle. I mean, it is a struggle of people Right, the same was for an increasing portion of the population being put in the deepest depth of misery, mm-hmm. and so forth. And so I just wondered, I know you had
so I appreciate the question and the tone of the question. And this is a very, very complicated area and very, very confusing.
Yes.
So one of the problems that happens is that often when you have a social problem,
yes.
you have the higher social classes or the higher social strata then take over that problem and find solutions that suit them.
Yeah.
So some of you may remember a couple months ago there was a guy who made a big splash about he called his credit card company and he never missed a payment and he asked for a reduction in interest rate and they raised his interest rate and yeah. lowered his thing. And he was a lawyer and he said he's not going to pay them anymore. He dares them to sue and they ended up settling somehow in some way. But he dared them to sue. So here we have a huge economic crisis. In fact, millions of people and this rich white lawyer who's never missed a payment wants his credit limit raised from 20,000 to 25,000, and his interest is low. I don't remember exactly what the exact interest thing, but then they said, we're going to raise your interest and keep your, well, you're at, he refused to make another payment. If he becomes the face of the credit problem, we
yeah.
lose.
Yeah.
And if they solve it,
yeah.
if they solve the crisis as it relates to wealthy white people,
yeah.
then we're going to lose.
Right.
That's the problem, that's the potential
yeah.
that we have for damage here,
yeah.
is that we could create a situation because we're trying to, quite frankly, we're trying to get families moved in who are media friendly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We could end up getting this whole middle class
exactly.
issue solved
yeah.
without addressing the
exactly.
land. And
exactly.
if we do that,
yeah.
if we do that, we are sellouts and we should be ostracized
right.
and judged
shot.
As such.
Shot.
We have
to say, but I know that's
the thing. With an organization called Brothers of the Same Mind, group in Liberty City, a group of ex-offenders, ex-felons. And so we did very, very good military work. And so people used to ask me, was I running for office? I'm like, I am never running for office. I don't know that. And I used to say, I'm running for office, I want you to shoot me. So we were in a room, and so someone asked me that question, and I was with, his brother, and I did the same thing. I'm running for office, you can't do change that way. If I run for office, shoot me. And one of the brothers who just got out, he said, in the leg or in the head? But also to figure out a way in which it potentially could have worked in some way, a year before or sometime before Rosa Parks sat down on the bus in that famous instance, there was another woman who did the same thing.
Right.
The NAACP would not take her case because she was a single mother.
Right.
And NAACP said the whole case was based around this floozy, and why this floozy was trying to sit wherever she wanted on the bus. She actually wanted to sit wherever she wanted on the bus so that she could seduce them. Obviously, everyone has a right to ride where they want on the bus, where they pay the same money, or even they don't pay the same money as everyone else on the bus. But the NAACP made a strategic decision saying that if we went with this person, then we would lose the case, while if we went with this person, we would win the case. And that's a similar, and I remember when I heard that for the first time when I was in college, I was completely flabbergasted and upset at the story that they would prioritize one person over another, but now I have some,
respect.
But we're not very comfortable with that decision
right.
at all, but we think that that's part of the tactic.
Well, that's my major point about the tactic, but you have to deal with some stuff.
Ron? I'm curious. What he was saying earlier, the mayor said earlier about the government gave the bank the gun money. So if they gave the bank the gun money for these homes that were supposed to be so-called foreclosed, then the people that were living in the home, shouldn't they have owned the home?
Yes.
Morally, right, it's just a moral nation. It's not a nation of morals. Which brings me to a statement I wanted to make, like how we got to this point, the anti-nation contract. Brother, two sons of them had a brother, from the K-Town anti-eviction campaign, who had just arrived in Chicago, just so it happened by coincidence, the day after the United Nations just left. Now, I was one who had put all my faith and hope that I've been organizing a bunch of years in human rights, right? The human rights denial, okay? This framework. And I know a lot about human rights, and I know the most about human rights I learned was that we was in our military, our armed forces, to enforce human rights. And I always love human rights. Like, we get gangster over human rights. We'll blow up some, excuse my language, some shit over human rights in this country, in this world. We will level a whole nation over them abusing
human
right. human rights of their citizens, their right. government. So United Nations comes here and do this city tour and meet with a bunch of directly impacted people across all the lines. And in a final report on the last day, she said, I'm going to release this full report. It's a damning report on America. Right. We're going to finally be found guilty of human rights violations. And we're going to announce this in the Human Rights Council. So bam, we get this copy. United States guilty of violating human rights and providing adequate housing for millions of Americans. Mm-hmm. Not just a couple hundred thousand, but we're talking genocide in numbers. So we're hoping that there'll be redress, right? United Nations could find you guilty. Most of Europe has started investing more money into their social housing, which is public housing here. But our country is taking a different role. Even if the United States say you're guilty, you need to provide more for your people. You need to enforce human rights at home. So what do? When the government itself, and this is what the United Nations was clear with us with, while you were there to be, ain't no blue heavens coming to America to liberate us. They ain't gonna post up back there, throw water off the back of the truck, open up some buildings. That's not gonna happen. So Ashcroft, you know, we're hearing this stuff, you know, he's like, I'm talking to the United Nations, and this is my past, like 3 years in a row. He's like, yeah, okay. But he just comes from guilty. Yeah, okay. What does that mean? You have to start putting up defenses yourself.
Exactly.
You have to create the crisis, you know what I'm saying, so that they can see, and then the UN will respond. You know, Magnum introduced us to Holly and them, because they did. You want to talk about the Bledsoe case briefly if you want to?
Happy birthday,
by the way. Can y'all kind of give us some inspiration about how you fought one, you know, and how the struggle continues?
I'm going to say something for you.
Okay, go ahead, Joe.
I want to counter-rebut something they said, and I was thinking about Rosa Parks when you brought it up. But I think that the problem that we're in the situation in the first place is because we're uncaring about poor people.
Yeah.
See, if we build movements around this middle class, or build movements around what we think society is going to accept, then we're still operating within the same system that's going to keep us in the same box. So we got to stop thinking outside the box, outside the system, and we really want to change this. See, if we stay inside the marginal area that they give us to appease the people, then we're not going to change things. So I was kind of accepting what you all were saying about the movement, and I got kind of turned off when you said you all didn't want to move into people that were mentally ill or substance abuse. You know, that's where I come from. This is my life. These are my people. And so I don't want to exchange that for nothing. I don't want to trade it for anything because we are the ones with them suffering all the time. You know, like the young lady speaking about the stimulus package and the bailout money. Black folks ain't gonna never get down with no new way. We always been suffering. We always been the same way. So whether things change for other people, it's not gonna change for us anyway. Right. So we have to have the people that care about our movement and care about how we feel. If we want to change housing across this country, across this land, we get to start with love people. We can't just pick a certain class of people and say, hey, we're gonna make this be the face of our movement, because that's what's been happening all the time. And everybody
will get locked up. So I appreciate the so you know this is the exact discussion we had internally. I do want to say about thinking outside the box. I'm not sure how much further outside the box we can think of than breaking the housing. We think we're able to challenge preconceived notions about what social relationships are and even legal relationships or appropriate legal relationships are in this country. And where we had the fight was not around whether or not street homeless or mentally ill or drug addicted people had the right to housing or need the right to housing. It was whether or not we could move someone in and have them stay there for a long period of time. So when we did the Emoja Village, which is when we took over a vacant lot and we built a shanty town there, we had no restrictions whatsoever on what anyone could get. We had mainly homeless individuals. And in the beginning, it was maybe 50-50. Towards the end, it was closer to 80-20 in terms of who was drug addicted and severely mentally ill who was there. And we handled it, and we dealt with it the best that we could. We also recognized that if we had people who, if we had some resources and some ability to put in the help that we wanted to put, that we could
provide more than just a roof for people, which is what we wanted to do. We wanted to improve their lives in more than ways than just providing four walls and roof. And we were not able to do that. And that was very frustrating for us. But the other thing is that recognizing the problems that we have inside of a vacant lot that we could deal with internally ourselves, which we did. We had the police come, who were, you know, called to come there three times, each of the three times, and called by someone else. Never any time did we deal with any of the issues that we had internally ourselves by calling the police. Always dealt with it ourselves. And we had some, you know, very unusual situations. Most of them were run-of-the-mill. We had a couple of very unusual situations. We did not think, based on that experience in there, that we could have, we have a family who's been in a house for a year, and they have neighbors on all four sides, a couple of empty houses on the same street. We don't think that if we were to move the vast majority of the residents who are in Mosa Village, any one of them in the house, that they would still be there in a year. Unless we'd be able to provide them with some significant social services. With that said, we feel like the people who lived in Mosa Village have just as much of a right to housing as they do, or again, as George W. Bush does, or as anyone else does. Mm-hmm. So it's a very complicated thing. So I just want to make clear, we made the decision that we made. I'm not trying to cover that up or say that we made something that we didn't or equivocate here. And this is a very, very difficult decision for, we did struggle with it a lot, and very difficult decision for us to make. Our final conclusion, however, was that we wouldn't be able to build a movement out over long term if we would have done another way. We got a lot of media. We got a lot of, it was overwhelmingly positive. It shocked us. We felt like we were doing something wrong because the media was so positive, so overwhelmingly positive. We don't think it would have been that way if it would have gone in, if the media would have showed up at the person's house and there would have been drug use going on at the house or people who would not have been taking care of themselves over at the house. And so we're very concerned about that. We didn't know how to deal with that. And just, you know, we had one instance where we had a family in. And it was a woman and her young children was in there. And she became more and more emotionally detached. And we were concerned that that raised a security issue for the children there. We didn't know how to deal. We weren't social workers. We're not social workers. We're not mental health professionals. We didn't know how to deal with that. We certainly were concerned that we would have it on our conscience if anything happened to the children. Unfortunately, nothing did. But she's no longer at the house. But her children were taken from her under some, you know, situations, which if it would happen at our house, I assure you I wouldn't be standing here today. So this is a very, very difficult, very, very complicated part of it, and it's not, I'm not very proud that we made that decision because we're not proud of it. We felt like we made it, and we feel like we need to be honest with it, honest about it so that people can understand what we struggle through and also try to struggle through things the same way in good faith.
And just for a point of clarity, you know, like, take back the land, don't dictate what local groups are doing. So if you wanted to do some organizing around moving mental health people into careers or ex-felons or whatever it may be, the local movement dictates. The people who operating on the ground, who have the role and responsibility, and who are going to do the work, they dictate what we're going to do, who we're going to defend, who we're going to move in.
Yeah, that's right. So we're not getting, that's the other thing, that's why we made the decision in Miami, we're not dictating that goes out in other places. People can do things the way that they need to do it. We're going to try to build it out. This is a very difficult thing, an ankle way for us to do, so.
Because Chicago is not like Miami. Let's not get it twisted. You know, we do the invasion blockades because it's kind of safe right now. We do have people committed to wanting to take over liberation and move in. But we have to be conscious of the way the Chicago Police Department operates and how King Richard II operates. You know what I'm saying? We have to be conscious. One of the cases we had down in Cabrini was, just real quick, when the niece was, we went in, we were going to do a move in, and they assigned a detective unit to us. Now, you know, my radars go up when I see detectives, because I'm saying, okay, you work on cases. And he assured us that he was there for us. Because had we moved in, I don't think we would have been facing a trespass. That's not the thing we learned, that we want to be there when they come to evict for the charges we face. We'll be a trespass or we're already in a unit versus going in a unit while the media out there. It's something you don't want to do anyway when the media out there is go in that unit. You know what I'm saying? That's proof you commit to felonious act.
Just one point.
I just wanted to say, I mean, I think what we all know is that this addiction is disproportionately affecting women of color. And Eric has been waiting to speak about what she's been through, so can maybe we get back to that discussion of what Eric has to say? If you don't mind me.
Hi, everybody. I'm Eric. Thank you.
say to North Point, like mostly all of my little brother's life, I'll be 35, and they're like the oldest one of my brothers is 25, so she had been there for like 12 years, I'll say. And when she was on her deathbed, I went to North Point and I asked her, was there anything that I could do because I was going to take over my nieces and nephews who my mother had custody of. So she told me that I would have 10 days to vacate the premises, and that was all. So I was like, well, is there anybody I can talk to over you, not trying to step on your toes or anything? And she was like, basically, no, you'll come back to me. And really, that's what it was. Luckily, my mother was taking care of this older lady, and she knew a lot of people that were working for HUD or whatever, so I explained to her what the situation was, and that's when I met Matt, my attorney, and everything just happened from there. It took a long time, like about a year and 3 months. So it was a lot of harassment. It was a lot of her, like, buying on me, saying I was doing drugs across the street in the park. All type of stuff, telling my brother he wasn't allowed on the premises, just everything. She tried it and tried it, and just whoever fighting, don't give up. And power by numbers. If you're not involved in your community, get involved. I'm young. I don't know. It's just like a movie I was watching as far as how the L system works. You didn't know that it's a billion people under the train station working for you. You know what I'm saying? And all the time, you just get on the bus and you ride with no cash. Me, same thing. I'm walking around. I see all my buildings and everything, but I don't really know what makes my community work until I got the ball. Until something happened to me. You know what I'm saying? And then one person leaned on another person leaned on that person, next thing I know, here I am meeting a whole shop of new faces. You know what I'm saying? So get involved, stay involved, don't be embarrassed. Say what you mean what you say, but also have an open mind. Change is good. Yeah. Obama, baby.
Give it up for
Do we feel comfortable continuing the conversation a little bit? Is that all right?
Yes.
Get a snack over here. Feel free to get the snack.
All right. Tomorrow, birthday.
We can come back and go next year.
Oh, yeah. Tip job.